6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard.
And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. In Egypt yesterday, the Egyptian army pushed the country pushed the country's first democratically elected president from power after days of massive street protests. It acted swiftly to remove the Islamist leader in favor of a coalition government and called for new elections to bring stability to a deeply polarized nation. President Mohamed Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood Party, in power just a year, remained defiant, insisting that they continued to be Egypt's legitimate authority. Some of Morsi's supporters threatened violent retaliation, but the Islamists appeared to be overwhelmed by tanks in the boulevards and hundreds, if not millions, of protesters streaming through villages and cities across the country. Fireworks exploded over the city when General Abdel Fattah Sisi, commander of the armed forces, went on television late Wednesday to declare that Judge Adli Mahmoud Mansour, head of the Supreme Constitutional Court, would replace Morsi. The court was one of Morsi's most potent enemies. The military, acting hours after the expiration of a 48-hour deadline it had given Morsi to restore stability, also scrapped the new Islamist draft constitution. This came, of course, on July 3rd, that this second phase, second round of the ongoing, what some people refer to as the ongoing Egyptian revolution, came on July 3rd, a day before this country, the United States, celebrates its revolutionary heritage with the 4th of July, with Independence Day. Back in the 1930s, the historian Arthur Schlesinger Sr., father of the, not to be confused with his son, the court historian for John Kennedy, wrote an essay in which he talked, he was asked what he thought the most significant contributions to the world were up until that point by the United States, from the United States. And he talked about the right to revolution and self-determination as the major contributions. That's playing out, obviously, in Egypt. It continues to play out across the world. And interestingly, it's being played out elsewhere at a time when many folks argue, observably, that the revolution that many people are celebrating today is in some ways eroding, has been subverted, and that democracy has actually been shrinking. Our guest today, Bob McChesney. Bob and his co-author John Nichols have just released a book entitled Dollarocracy: How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We're going to talk about that today. We're going to talk about what has taken place in recent years, and then we're going to discuss what is to be done, that historic question. So, Bob, thank you very much, of course, for making it in on this, our Independence Day. But, I'm always glad to see you staring at me across the table here. I'm going to start with a brief quote here from the introduction of Dollarocracy. The type of society we have is far better understood as a dollarocracy than as a democracy. We have a system that is now defined more by $1, one vote, than by one person, one vote. We live in a society where a small number of fabulously wealthy individuals and giant corporations control most of the dollars and, by extension, have most of the political power. They buy election results that give them control over the government, and they hire lobbyists to fine-tune that control so that the distribution of wealth and income continually skews to their advantage. This passage goes on, says our, meaning your, Bob and John's, argument is simply that the degree of difficulty that citizens confront when they seek to use the election process to effectively control government policies is vastly higher than it has been in memory, a higher difficulty in utilizing that system. And it will only get worse unless Americans do something about it. A difficult truth lurks not far in the future. If our elections get appreciably more corrupt, extending the trajectory they were already on in 2012, the use of the term democracy to describe the United States will be inaccurate in even the weakest sense of the term. A pessimistic read at the beginning of this book, but a realistic read. Bob, let's jump right into this. What do you and John refer to? What do you mean when you talk about the money and media election complex?
John and I have been working on this concept for a long time. I've been writing about political advertising and the growth of money that has gone into campaigns that mostly goes to political advertising. And the other side of the coin, these large media conglomerates that make most of this money, most of the money that gets spent on campaigns ends up in the coffers of a very small number of large media corporations. And so I've always been interested in this relationship going back to the 90s and been writing about it sort of parenthetically in works that I've done. John and I have been talking about it for a long time. With the Citizens United case, I think that brought to crystallized a new stage in which unlimited private, corporate, or individual financing of campaigns, effectively anonymous, so we don't really know who's spending the money, is the new order of the day. So people can spend vast sums and no one really knows who's spending it or what exactly they're spending it on. And this sort of elevated this complex, we think, to a new level. So we have the 2012 election, for example, by our calculation, it was a $10 billion election when you add in all the money that was spent and raised. And the conventional wisdom says it's a $6 billion election, which is ridiculous. That was based on just not looking at all the races, not adding up all the numbers. And that's, you know, more than double what was spent in 2008. And we have more of that coming down the road. And the complex is basically these media conglomerates that run these moronic ads that marinate our airways and make a fortune off of it. The news media, which doesn't cover politics whatsoever anymore, and what little coverage there is purely inane horse race coverage. And they sort of feed the system and play off the advertising and the marketing. And then you've got a whole class now of consultants who sort of guide the campaign, direct the money, spend it. And you've got these shadowy super PACs, which are now emerging as these secretive organizations. Again, they milk the loopholes in the tax code, which the Supreme Court in the Citizens United case conveniently just ignored and said this couldn't happen, but we don't care if it does really, in effect, because they're signing off on it, that allows this money to be secretive and unchecked. And in combination, what we've got is a system now, and to go back to the quote you read, where if someone wants to run for public office today, someone who wants to be a public servant, just wants to do well by their community, whatever the job is, they aren't out, like most members of Congress, looking for their next job as a lobbyist at $1 million a year, which is where most members of Congress go now when they leave Congress. If they just want to be what we traditionally think of as a public servant, they have to spend so much time just raising money to sort of keep their nose above sea level for advertising, since there's no press coverage, and cultivating the people who can provide the money, that it renders their ability to actually either be successful or to be successful and pursue public service very difficult.
What's its function? What is the function of this dollarocracy? What does it do? That is, clearly there's this diminishing of democracy, but in the book you talk about this kind of reduction.
Well, you know, I think
contraction of democracy.
Let's put it, since you started on a historical vein and it's July 4th, let's put it in a historical vein.
Good.
At the moment of the revolution, if you go right back to read the Declaration of Independence through the Constitution, there's always been, the United States has never been sort of a singular experience. It's been a heterogeneous experience. And so you can go back and look at it and you can see that from the beginning, there were people, even at the time of the revolution, who opposed the revolution but went along reluctantly but despised the idea of revolution, like John Adams or Alexander Hamilton. They were dragged into it kicking and screaming, or John Jay, and they held to the belief that those who own the country ought to govern it. And then there's also another theme that made the revolution, which was the all men or all people are created equal. The revolution is the right of a people to assert their freedoms. And there's been a tension throughout our history between the idea those who own the country ought to govern it and between those who don't own the country who think they ought to govern it. And it's played itself out in many different ways. It's been the enduring struggle. It has its ups and downs. And it's not entirely a history of the bad guys or those with property winning. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have Social Security. We never would have labor unions. Women wouldn't be voting. We wouldn't get rid of slavery. I mean, those things all happened because people who didn't have property rose up and won these great victories. And I'd say right now we should understand dollarocracy is basically the latest extension of this tension. But it's assumed heights now that were difficult. No one could have anticipated even a few generations ago, where we have inequality at extraordinary levels. We're going back a century to find similar inequality. We're finding stagnation in the economy. You have to go back 8 decades to find similar stagnation. We're finding corruption in governance. You have to go back again a century. And with the system of dollar, I guess the way John and I look at it is that as gloomy as it looks and as pessimistic as that paragraph you read looked, the other side of the coin is that the great majority of people in this country are not enthusiastic about dollarocracy. The evidence is in. On polling and demonstrations, when talking to people at every level, the great bulk of people in this country don't like this sort of country, don't want this to be the United States. And I think the best evidence that there's the great bulk of people are opposed to this comes from the U.S. Supreme Court and the corporate right, because the two issues they have been most obsessed with in the last 5 years or 10 years, especially, but they've been obsessed with them forever. One is allowing unlimited corporate money and billionaire money into elections so they can make it easier to buy elections. And two, they want the ability to suppress the vote because they know they can't win a fair election if there's a turnout of 55 or 60 or 65%. Lord knows if we had a turnout of 75 or 80% of everyone over 18 in this country, the Republican parties that's presently constituted, much of the Democratic Party would be have much less support, and they'd have to change their tune or new parties would probably emerge. So suppressing vote has become order job number one in today's politics. Hence those two great Supreme Court decisions, Citizens United and then the voting rights decision 2 weeks ago. Those were two decisions that we argue in the book, anticipating the voting rights decision. Even before the cases came along, we knew how the Supreme Court majority was going to vote. Those were sort of like litmus test issues. That's why Roberts is there to run the Supreme Court, to deliver the goods so that those who own the country can govern it. That's his mission in life.
Let's continue on in that vein. That this just didn't, these Supreme Court rulings that you just noted didn't come from the sky, but they're the part of a continuum that's been going on for, well, the book talks about for 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to Justice Powell, for instance. Talk about that a little bit. I don't know if our listeners are familiar with Powell. And,
I think the place to go is that one of the last great upsurge of popular political activity that's been very successful in the United States was in the 1960s and early 70s. And Alan, you and I are old enough to remember that period. But it was a period in which we got the Voting Rights Act, we got Medicare. It was also the period of the Vietnam War, which was the overlay of the era. But there were these victories won in the context of this gruesome illegal war at the same time. But from the eyes of big business, from corporate America, they looked at a political climate between 1965 and 1972, which they saw as distinctly hostile. There was very little public enthusiasm for corporations. Ralph Nader was a public hero. The idea that corporations were sort of sleazy organizations that really weren't contributing to the public good was much more widely held than it had been in the past, or is now it's held in the same view, but still recent times it was sort of fallen out of view. And Lewis Powell, who was a successful corporate attorney and had represented the tobacco industry and made a fortune doing so, was greatly alarmed by the fact that tobacco advertising had been thrown off commercial television, that the sort of public interest groups had been able to sort of put a stranglehold on this cash cow for him and what he saw as a center of free enterprise in America. So he, for the Chamber of Commerce, wrote a memo shortly before he was nominated for and put on the U.S. Supreme Court, arguing that Ralph Nader was public enemy number one, that young people in America had an insufficient appreciation of corporate power, that the whole country was getting away from the sort of the traditional rulers ruling it. And there was way too much democracy in the country, as it's been understood. And what was required was for business, big business, the largest corporations, to devote lots of money to politics, to basically take over the government, take over the judiciary, take over the media, take over the reins of power so that the government, those who own the country, would again govern it. And that was what he said. He said it baldly. And it was widely distributed among corporate CEOs and wealthy interests. And now, whether that memo exactly led to everything that followed, that's who knows. But what we do know is that within the next decade, virtually every major corporation had increased its spending on lobbying and politics dramatically. Every trade association representing industry, most of which had their headquarters in New York or somewhere else, like Detroit, if you're in the automobile industry, all moved their headquarters to Washington. There was a tenfold increase in the number of corporate lobbyists in a decade. You know, they took this very seriously. And Lewis Powell, when he was put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon the next year in 72, in his confirmation hearings, this didn't even come up. No one talked about it. They don't know about it. It was a confidential memo. It didn't come up till later. But when he got to the Supreme Court, his number one cause, and he was always presented as a moderate, Lewis Powell, the moderate on the court. And you're in the court, you're moderate if you're a moderate, if that's defined by certain issues like social issues. But on corporate power, this guy was the most rabid extremist imaginable till Roberts came along and Scalia and Alito. Because he was from the first days in the court obsessed with the idea that corporations should have the same privileges as people, and the corporations should be allowed to, and people, unlimited campaign donations. He really believed in his bone marrow that wealth should be able to be unencumbered to buy election influence, and it was his defining mission. And it didn't come true till after his death with Citizens United. We chronicle this in detail in the book. Interestingly enough, you know, William Rehnquist was opposed to this. I mean, this was not an easy sell to traditional conservatives, the idea that corporations should have the same power as individuals, or that all that 100 years of election law that had been passed in every state, all sorts of communities that called for limitations to make elections fair and equal, should all be thrown out by the Supreme Court with its new radical interpretation of the Constitution, which is what Powell wanted and which we eventually got with Citizens United. So what we saw was a great counter-revolution in the 70s against the victories of the 60s. And dollarocracy is the result of that counter-revolution. It is a takeover of the politics, the success of dominating the political system, and of getting policies put in place that enhance the wealth and privileges of the few and, you know, make the life of the many worse.
Our guest today is Bob McChesney. Bob McChesney, co-author with John Nichols of Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. You know, I think you're right, Bob, in saying, you know, some people like to fetishize, if you will, individual actors, and then it kind of often tapers off into kind of conspiratorial non-analysis. But, of course, Powell was just one of many who looked at the upsurge, the Democratic upsurge, from below, the popular movements and what they demanded of the system, either entry or increased security and benefits from the system, they viewed it as an enemy, as something that had to be curtailed. We know about the governability of democracies, that study done by the Trilateral Commission.
Yeah, which we talk about in the book. Extraordinary study.
I have it on my desk right now. It's always there. Yeah. Because of it was kind of a forecast. And Sam Huntington, one of this kind of conservative political scientist, academic, and you know, said you know, as the lead author, wrote that there was a problem with the governability of democracies, and the problem was that there was too much.
That's right.
That too many groups, interest groups, meaning women, people of color, trade unionists, et cetera, were too expensive.
Actually, he put it even more profoundly, more presciently than that. He said, the problem we have today, wrote in the 70s, and analyzing the upsurge of the late 60s, early 70s, is that traditionally apathetic groups of the population, blacks, women, young people, young workers, traditionally apathetic groups that basically didn't pay attention to politics were suddenly making demands on the system and acting like they had a role to play, and that the system didn't work then. The system only worked when traditionally apathetic people returned to their couches and let the owners run society. That's when democracy works, is when there's not democracy.
Right. And, of course, this came in tandem with a turn in the U.S. economy. The golden age, commonly referred to as the golden age, the prosperity of the post-war boom of the 50s and 60s was coming to an end by the early mid-70s, corresponding with the issuance of such statements. And that, you know, we just can't, this kind of government and think tank, I like this term, what is it, coin-operated think tanks?
Yeah, coin-operated think tanks.
These folks saying, well, we just can't afford this. And it's not only an issue of democracy, but they're putting a squeeze on our profits.
Yeah, and that's right. There's a structural factor here. I mean, this is not, there's a historical moment in which it was seen by those atop the economy that the system wouldn't work unless they repressed the demands of those at the bottom, and they had to do cutbacks, had to become the order of the day. And Business Week magazine put it famously in 1975, it was assessing the politics of business and said, what we have to do, and it's going to be a tough sell, so we have to convince the population they have to do with less so business can do with more. That's the mission of our generation, of our era. And that was exactly it. Now, of course, you don't say that directly. You have to that's where public relations comes in and plays its glorified role in having all the sound bites and spin and hot air. But in effect, if you study closely what business, how they saw it and understood it, from Lewis Powell to the Trilateral Commission to Business Week magazine, they understood exactly what was at stake politically.
You're listening to Bob McChesney, co-author of Dollarocracy and longtime friend of WRT. Give us a call at 256-2001 if you have a question or a comment. Kelsey is with us here in the studio today, and she's got her laptop open and can take, if you have a question, we've become so media savvy here at WRT that we can take a and we have a Twitter feed, and it's at WRT Talk, one word, WRT, at WRT Talk. If you want to type in, send a tweet with a question for our guest today. Convincing the population, right? The role, I mean, you're talking about this, not only this money, but this media complex that you've written about. So, you know, it's mm-hmm. your specialization, your mm-hmm. forte. The role that it plays in convincing the population in at so many levels. Let's unpack that a little bit.
Well, even before we unpack that, I mean, one of the points we try to make in the book that I still think is grossly underappreciated is just how few Americans vote compared to other countries, and what a decisive issue that is for understanding the nature of our politics, and why that's not an accident, and why that's, you know, that is exactly the way the Huntingtons and Lewis Powells of the world like it. Because voting in the United States, going back to deep into the century, voting in the United States has always been class bound. I mean, people in the top 15% vote at twice the rate of people in the bottom 15%. So the average voter in an American election is oftentimes from the 60th or 65th percentile, not the 50th in terms of wealth, the median voter. And what that means, it also means that in America we have a much lower turnout. So we get basically 50 or 55% turnout of people over 18 to vote, and that's considered a great year. You know, we had 52, I think, in 2012, and that's of all people over 18. And if we ever got, I think we had high 50s in 2008, and that people are doing backflips. They're, you know, that's an amazing year. Well, in most large democratic nations, that would be a major scandal to have a voter participation rate under 70%. In many, it gets up into 80, 85. Venezuela, which Jimmy Carter said is the most democratic elections in the world, at 82%. Now, Venezuela had a 50% turnout like we get. You know, we probably would have invaded the country for not having a democracy, for being a scam. But the point is that our elections, who votes, is skewed very heavily towards those with money. And right there you have a real problem. And we really, there's the system is set up to discourage the participation of those who don't have money. And when that's not effective, we get voter suppression. And one of the striking things, this goes back to the 1950s or 60s, political scientists determined that if the United States voted at the same rates as Western European nations, so that the working class voted at the same rate as the upper middle class and the upper class, our politics would, unless the politics were complete, the parties were completely impervious to any change, which today might be the case, but our politics would move dramatically to the left. I mean, there's a clear, you know, class bias here that mitigates against public education, social spending, full employment, union rights, all sorts of things that the lower two-thirds of the population is sympathetic to and the upper third is not sympathetic to, that we lose out on. And what was striking to us in Dollarocracy was that both political parties have accepted this. You would think that the Democratic Party, being the ones who are more likely to get the votes of the people who don't vote were they to vote, and all the evidence shows that, would be out saying, let's get these people to vote. Let's, you know, this is our chance to win elections. And what was striking to us is one of the real stories of Dollarocracy isn't just that the Republican Party is completely a far right-wing party now, and it's, you know, it's way to the right, off the rails of what it was 40 years ago. But it's that the Democratic Party, the real story, has followed in its wake and has become a vastly more conservative party, much more comfortable with Dollarocracy than it would have been in the 60s or early 70s. And the best evidence of that came from a study done by Fran Piven and Richard Cloward. And they talked about, they did some research, and they looked at the 1984 election when Walter Mondale was running as Reagan. Reagan was running for re-election. And the polls showed Mondale getting crushed. And so Mondale's team, several months before the election, commissioned a study. Is there any way we can possibly win this election? And they went out, and Mondale's campaign manager organized a study, and they said, this is how we can win the election. What we basically do is we have to get the voter participation rate up from 50 to, say, 60 or 62%. We have to bring in people of color, young people. We have to bring in first-generation immigrants. We have to bring in women. We have to draw in all the people who are sort of alienated from the process because they don't see anything in it, give them a reason to vote. And if we register them and get them to vote, we can win this election because those votes will go overwhelmingly to us, and that would be enough to win us the election. And they presented that information to the Democratic Party, and it rejected it. It said, basically, no, we'd rather stick with the existing electorate and take our chances there. And I think the tension there that Piven and Cloward saw, and I think it's obvious, was that at the commanding heights of the Democratic Party, they were working very comfortably with major funders who were more or less in tune with Dollarocracy, you know, be they on Wall Street or wherever. And they were not excited about the idea of having the Democratic Party become a mass-based popular politics party to win an election. They'd rather lose elections and stick to where they were. And that at that fork in the road, the Democrats put themselves in a path that clearly they've stayed on to this day.
You know, that brings – I'm going to get – I definitely want to get back to this whole PR media end of it. But you know, your last riff – you know, brought me to, you know, a question, a point in the book, that is that after the last presidential election, there were all these liberal and Democratic pundits who said, aha, you know, that despite all the money that the Republicans pumped into the campaign, that it and the media and the messaging and so on, that it didn't work, that indeed the people knew better and so on. But you take issue, you and John take issue with that.
Well, Obama raised just about the same amount of money as Romney, very close. And he spent it better, which we document. He had a smarter campaign and a better campaign. But the Obama campaign spent a ton of time raising lots of money in the Upper East Side of Manhattan from hedge fund guys, Wall Street guys, from billionaires. Obama was, you know, camping out there doing fundraising. We documented it in the book. I mean, they were playing by the same game. Of course, they wouldn't advertise their commitment to Dollarocracy as loudly. That's not going to work with their voting base, because one of the problems they have is the voting base of the Democratic Party, the people who got Obama elected, are well to the left of Obama on issue after issue after issue. So they're running on the fact that they're not Republicans. They don't want to look too much like Republicans, so that will dissuade their people from voting. But, you know, I think you look at actual policies. I mean, that's the proof of it. Yeah, Obama won, but, you know, how many people on Wall Street are in jail? You know, none. You know, Obama won, but the big banks are bigger than ever. You know, Obama won, but they're still talking about cutting Social Security, even though I think it's safe to say the vast majority of people voted for Obama voted for him because they want to protect Social Security from the Republicans. But that doesn't matter. So we're seeing all sorts of issues here where money wins, no matter who's in power. And as you go down ticket, that's even really, we talk a lot about this in the book, because the presidential race gets all the attention because that's the only race media covers now, except for occasional statewide races. There's zero press coverage, basically, effective press coverage of the vast majority of races in the country, including races for state Supreme Court, which are really essential. And in these races, we find money comes in and basically buys the outcomes. Since there's no press coverage, there's nothing to base it on. If you can flood a race for a referendum or for a city council or even a mayor in some cities with money, you can win it, and you can win extraordinary victories. So Sheldon Adelson, who's made fun of as the moron who spent all this money and didn't get anything out of it, he just after the election was laughing. How can you say that? We went into Michigan and we defeated a right to have a union law referendum in Michigan, and by defeating that, it led the Republican governor to pass a bill, you know, getting rid of unions in the private sector, making it possible to dump them. That was a victory we won. I paid for that. You know, I wrote the check that got us that in Michigan. We bought a bunch of judges all over the country in state Supreme Court that can overrule anything lower courts do in their state. They think they won that election. You know, so, and I think there's a lot of evidence they have. And if they didn't win, they're going to come back for. Again, though, having said that, the great majority of people in this country don't support this, which is why they have to spend so much, which is why they've got to suppress the vote. That's the great tension. So I don't want people to think we're saying this is going on, there's nothing we can do about it. They know they're in a distinct minority. The problem is that it would be wonderful if we had an opposition party that said this and stood up to them and had alternative policies. They own both parties. That's the problem. The Democratic Party, though, their voting base is progressive. So they can't say that as directly, and they can't be quite as harsh. But in terms of policies, if you look at what the Democratic Party has done in power for the last 20 years, it has been, you know, what would have been the generation earlier, a moderate Republican Party, moderate to conservative, and by Western European standards, certainly a Christian Democratic Party.
Yeah, but regardless, every election cycle comes around, and there's countless people who say, well, we got to vote for them. We got to vote for the Democrats because what's the alternative? Look what's worse. You know, we just, Carol, our phone answer, just someone called in with a question. Who do we vote for? That is, who really is worthwhile to vote for in these times? It's a related question. That is,
well, our argument is that you shouldn't vote telling people who to vote for. And we're not even saying don't vote for Democrats because you're scared of Republicans. We don't think that's an irrational response at all. It does make a difference. There are differences. The problem we face is that the range of debate that you get that's locked in by dollarocracy is so irrelevant in so many respects to the great issues that face this country. You know, the country's falling apart, living standards are collapsing, core social programs are under attack, and neither party's really talking about doing anything about it. I mean, there is a difference between them, though. There's no question about it on certain issues. It's an important difference. But, you know, we don't have a politics that deals with the issues the American people are concerned about. And that's the great chasm we have. And the debate is nowhere near where the American people would like that debate to be. I think the logic of our argument is, you know, keep that in mind as you vote. Keep that in mind as you think about candidates. But it also means that as the system, as voter suppression goes through, as it will now in state after state, as the money gets ramped up more and more, believe it or not, it's going to get worse. You have to think about other mechanisms of representing your political interests besides the election, because elections are limited. I think civil disobedience, obviously, demonstrations are a big part of what we do. I think just grassroots, you know, on the ground organizing, raising hell. You know, I think that that's the logical. I mean, I think that's not just logical here, it's logical worldwide. I mean, look, in Egypt, if you want to get attention, you put a few million people in the streets. You don't just sit around and wait till the next election. That gets attention.
Or Brazil, or Turkey, or Tunisia.
Everywhere. And, you know, it's on July 4th, one of the things we should be proudest of in the American Constitution, in the American experience, is probably, I would argue, certainly tied for first among the most cherished rights in the First Amendment is the right to assemble. Because nothing scares people in power more than looking out the window and seeing 50,000 people nonviolently exercising their right to protest. Nothing gets their attention more. You could have a million people on a Facebook page, they couldn't care less, they'll delete the page. But you put 50,000 people outside the window closing down traffic saying we've got, and then you have trouble in River City. And that's why it's in our Constitution, because it was understood by the people who started this country, the good guys, that that's a core. Once you lose that right, it makes the ability of tyranny to survive much greater.
And that's also, one could argue, why we have this incredible metastasizing of the national surveillance and security state domestically.
Oh, that they're scared to death of that. They're scared to death. I think people in power, as a rule, whoever it is, are scared to death of citizens coming together in large numbers and seeing they've got a lot in common with lots of other people, and they share values. That freaks them out. That always has from the beginning, and it does to this day. And that's why they do everything in their power to minimize that threat. You know, it's reached, we're getting way off topic here,
sorry, but we're having a conversation.
We're having a conversation.
4th of July.
You know, it's reached the absurd point where for, you know, the last 20 years now, when people wanted to demonstrate at political conventions, so they wouldn't bother the participants in the conventions and the news media wouldn't notice them, demonstrations were put like 10 or 20 or 30 blocks away in sort of a cordoned off pig pen. Yep. And they were given the great name free speech zones.
Yeah, free speech zones.
Free speech zones. So like, you know, you thought the whole country was supposed to be a free speech zone, not like two blocks, you know, 40 yeah. blocks away from the convention.
Bob, let's get back to you used that phrase before, the need to convince the population. Talk a little bit about, you know, again, part of this, we're talking about this money and media election complex, this need to propagandize, really, to shape public opinion, and which actually, you know, works to disempower people.
Well, this is something that, you know, the Powell memo spelled out, and that everyone at that time understood it was an issue, that the news media coming out of the 60s and the early 70s was seen as insufficiently supportive of business. It was seen as too willing to investigate the powerful, too sympathetic to people like Ralph Nader, too willing to go after the military and big business. And that was seen as a major problem. They had to have a news media and a general culture that worshipped and respected and exalted the role of business and was skeptical about the idea of altering the status quo. So that was mission critical. Now, in terms of news media, the way that was done through a number of measures was to set up sort of media criticism, to continually badger the media as being liberals, to force them to be more conservative in their view, basically respect Republican ideas more thoroughly. And then the big leap was, of course, to create their own media, starting with talk radio in the late 80s and then Fox News Channel, which became the sort of aggressive mouthpieces of the politics and had the wonderful and delicious effect for dollarocracy of, since traditional journalists, and we go in depth about their weaknesses in there and I have in my career, but traditional journalists see their job as basically reporting what people in power are saying and being fair to both sides, the Republicans and Democrats, accurately reporting what they say, not really challenging it. That's what a traditional journalist does. A traditional journalist is loath to be caught injecting their own opinion unless they can say someone in power said it and I'm just quoting them. So they're not going to ask questions that fall outside the range of existing debate between those in power, the heads of the Republicans and Democratic Party. Well, what Fox News basically said was, we're not going to wait around. We're going to create the news and force everyone to take us seriously, make news. And so the conservatives actually, because they're so well organized, use their conservative media to set the news cycle for the other rest of the media. You know, they're constantly setting the news cycle. So you go on MSNBC or listen to Air America, and they're constantly talking about Bill O'Reilly and Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, I can't watch them anymore for that reason.
But you listen to Rush Limbaugh, he can care less what Rachel Maddow is talking about, because he's setting the agenda. She's responding to him. He's pitcher. She's catcher. And they take advantage of that to create completely bogus issues to fill the news, like that IRS scandal a few weeks ago, or all these things they cook up. You know, they got, what's that wonderful voter registration group they got closed down on a completely fraudulent scandal? And now my mind's blanking, old age brain freeze, for which I apologize. You're even older, Alan, so you've got an excuse.
I do have an excuse.
Kelsey, you don't have an excuse.
it'll come. It had tree in it. Or oak or something. But I know exactly what you're talking about. While we recompose here, let's go to the phones. We have a caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for the program. It was interesting to listen to you I've heard both of you before, but one question remains is the first thing, even on local elections, people won't go out and vote. I think in this last election we had in April, I think there was like 20% or 25%. So even local election where even if there's money thrown in here, people don't vote when it might make a difference because they know the people and they're in a local area like a city or a municipality. And the second question I have, it was interesting how money plays the role in this and that both parties are moving to the right, meaning even the Democratic Party sets up a false straw man and then says, well, we can't do it, and Obama's been doing that for ever since he's been elected. The problem is the American people won't get out and demonstrate. They tried with Occupy, and that kind of blew up in their face, and because of the power of the police and the security state. So my question is, how long do you think it will be before there will be a change? Because in Wisconsin, I do not expect ever to have, in the rest of my lifetime, ever to see another Democrat party plurality, either in the assemblies of the Senate, and, of course, the governor will never be another Democrat.
Well, let me try to answer that question. First of all, don't be pessimism can become self-fulfilling. Let me tell you a quick story that I've never forgotten since it happened. I had a professor in graduate school who was a South African, a white South African, who'd immigrated to the United States in the 1960s because he was against apartheid. But his family had remained in South Africa, and he stayed in close touch with them. And in 1987, 87 or 88, it was right before I moved to Madison, I went into his office, and he was very despondent. And he said, all my family in South Africa are getting out. They're leaving the country. They say the current white government in South Africa refuses to negotiate. Apartheid is irretractable, and that there will be massive bloodshed if there's ever going to be social change. It's hopeless. It's never been more grim in South Africa in hundreds of years than it is today. And this was in 1987 or 1988. 2 years later, Nelson Mandela is released from prison. 6 years later, he's president of South Africa. And how many people died in that upheaval? A handful. So we can't expect the future. In 2010, if someone said that the demonstrations in Madison were going to take place, no one would have believed it. So be open-minded. We can't predict the future. We see a wave of protests across the world now that are unprecedented for decades, maybe unprecedented for generations. So we should just be aware that we can't predict the future. What we do know, though, is that the type of society the United States is today is not tenable. We have a situation with extraordinarily limited opportunities for young people, the worst world for young people to come into in at least since the Depression. It's at least 80 years. We have gaping corruption and inequality, mindless militarism. Most people don't even know the countries we're fighting or why we're fighting them. It's right out of Orwell's playbook. It's an absurd situation. It's untenable. It can't last. So just be open-minded and prepare for the fact that when crisis does get more pronounced or more evident that uprising takes place, that we can resolve it in a good manner and get that sort of solution that would create a tenable world we'd want to live in. That should be our objective, is because it's going to happen. It's just we don't know when. As for voter turnout, it's low. Well, I think people don't vote rationally in many cases. They don't think it really matters. I understand that. I vote. I think it does matter, even in minor reasons. But do understand that these Republicans like Scott Walker, they all win their elections in non-presidential years because governor races are then. If Scott Walker had to run in a presidential year when a lot more poor people vote, when the voter rate goes way up, it'd be much more difficult for Scott Walker to be governor of this state or Scott in Florida or that dude in Michigan or the guy in Pennsylvania. They'd probably all be out.
You know, let's talk a little bit, continuing on this theme of the role of the media.
Oh, yeah, Acorn is the name of that
Acorn.
Girl.
Acorn.
Thank
Acorn.
You, God.
Yes,
God, I'm losing it here, yeah.
Yeah, I knew it had a tree.
Yeah, let's get that Alzheimer's medicine working quickly, please.
No jest. That one of the things that the media does, and Kelsey sitting here with us reminded me that there's this kind of image of those who protest, those who carry out civil disobedience. They're painted as crackpots, hippie has become a ubiquitous. It's just a bunch of hippies out there, or old leftovers, and so on. And that this has effect in some ways of you know, tainting the perceptions of a younger generation who think that it's not cool or even lame to protest, to get out there, to join in such movements. Of course, the contradiction to that is the youth participation in the Occupy movement.
Well, you know, I think from going back when I was in college, the overriding undercurrent, if I can use such an absurd phrase, of our political culture is that it's not cool to be political. I mean, it was clear to me in the early 70s that was the vibe that was came out, not cool to be political. You know, being political was like no fun. It was a bunch of whining
people. Don't bum me out, man.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, so it just wasn't cool. And that's still the dominant trend. I mean, it's cool to be apolitical. It's cool to not to let people in power just run the country and don't bother them. And we have to battle that head on. I mean, I think the depoliticization is the greatest problem we face across the entire population. The idea that politics is uncool, it's lame, it's boring. You know, politics is rigged. Politics is unfair. Politics is corrupt. But that doesn't mean that you just give up. It means you've got to redouble your efforts, because it defines the world everyone lives in. Whether you like it or not, politics is there. You can't avoid it. So I think that I think that, you know, that's an issue we have to always address. But I will also say one thing related to that, Alan, which is that, you know, one of the things that was striking in Occupy, and especially in the Wisconsin uprising, and I think we're seeing it worldwide, is that in the 60s and 70s, there's a traditional split between young people who were sort of like versus like working class people who were separated and like, you know, hard hats, and they make a big deal out of that. I think that was exaggerated to some extent in the early 70s. There was a really radical grassroots workers movement at that time by historical standards, certainly nothing like it since then. But there was an element or two to it, too, and I can speak for my own family. I've bet a lot of listeners had the same experience with their families. But I think that's gone. I think that a lot of those issues, which were about sexuality, which were about lifestyle, which were about whatever, have disappeared. And I think now there's a much more of a common ground. I think there's much more grounds for solidarity between heterogeneous communities in this country than there was at that time. And so I think there's, from my perspective as a Democrat, small d Democrat, very hopeful signs that there's a lot of common ground for people to build on values compared to 40 or 50 years ago.
We just have a few minutes left, but we do have a caller. Hello, caller, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, fellow crackpots. I find that one thing has been really helpful in talking to people who are disillusioned and who are saying, oh, piss on it, the Republicans, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Watch
all
the
things you said which mitigate against people taking part. But there is one thing that's right out in front of us which is never picked up by the corporate media, and that is on the entire continent of South America, there's only one fascist government left, and Colombia is propped up as a partially or maybe wholly owned subsidiary of the CIA. So it gives people something to hold out as a real success for mostly nonviolent resistance.
Thank you, caller.
And it helps in my organizing.
Thank you,
caller. In my life.
You know, I couldn't agree more with you, caller. That was a really good point. You know, I think that during the Cold War, one of the problems that happened to the left was it was seen as a phenomenon that was anti-democratic, sort of a minority putsch mentality, that it was uncomfortable with the outcome of a free election because it couldn't win. So when it took power, it would abandon the whole idea of free elections, of civil liberties, you know, instead continents, a Soviet-type state. And I think that I think that's anomalous. I don't think that is the left tradition, but I think it's a part of the tradition the left has to deal with as it makes sense of the world. And I think now we're getting back to really what the left is, which is a majoritarian movement of the great bulk of people in the society. And we're seeing in South America, as you said, extraordinary political successes. not without their complications, as anything will be, but still extraordinary and successes. And again, for people who are gloomy about the times, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, if you were to make a tour of South America in the 1990s, you would have had all sorts of people talking about, well, it won't change here for 100 years. It's hopeless. It's impossible. And now look, in country after country after country, optimism is at all-time highs.
We got a few minutes left, Bob, and I want to turn to the latter part of the book. That is your and John's call, not for a specific reform, but what you refer to as a great reform movement, a revival of a great reform movement, in which, here's a quote again, in which an array of amendments, laws, rules, and structural and social responses are initiated and implemented. And then, of course, you highlight the right to vote as affirmed in the Constitution. Talk about that, please.
Well, I don't think we're going to win any major reform on its own in this country. The strength of dollarcrats, of powerful interests, are way too great. I mean, even right now, elementary environmental stuff can't get through because of the energy companies. Elementary financial reform, the Tobin tax, can't get through because of Wall Street's power. At issue after issue after issue, we can't win. We're only going to win when we have enough people mobilized, raising hell, that you win a whole array of things. That's how it always happens. That's how it was in the New Deal. That's how it was in the 60s. That's how it was in Reconstruction. And I think if you look at the periods of reform in American history, going back to Reconstruction, Progressive Era, New Deal in the 60s, one thing that jumps out is each of them, there were three or four constitutional amendments passed, all of which would have were seemed impossible to pass 5 years before they were passed. Can't pass that. Impossible. And by the time they were passed with popular acclaim. And they did so because in every case, there were popular movements raising hell in the streets, at the ballot box, changing, say, this has to be done. We got to get this country back in line. So we think if we're going to have a period of the sort of reform we need, history suggests we're almost certainly going to have a series of constitutional amendments, getting the money out of politics, guaranteeing the right to vote. We're one of the few democracies in the world that doesn't guarantee the right to vote, which makes all this suppression going on in state after state, including Wisconsin, viable. It should be thrown out. It's obscene that we'd let it, making it possible to suppress the vote. And so we need to pass our series of constitutional amendments to right the ship. Fundamental restructuring. And this was how our Constitution was meant to be used, and progressives have always known that. You know, they didn't. The people who wrote the Constitution, those who own the country should govern it, but the ones those who don't own the country should govern it. That crowd thought the Constitution should be revisited constantly. We should be rethinking it every generation. They didn't expect this to be cast in stone and unchangeable. And we need to have the right to vote. We need to get corporations out of politics. We need to guarantee a right to an education and to health care. There are certain fundamental things that advanced democracies have to have as guaranteed rights, and we need to do that as constitutional campaigns. And they're great organizing tools. That's the other reason you do them. They're great ways to bring issues out, talk about issues, not politics, not BS. Here's the issue, and get support and generate popular interest and mobilize movements.
Bob, we got to let go. A minute or so left. You kind of summed it up just now, but any parting shots, if you will, a firecracker perhaps on the 4th of July?
There's a ton of stuff that we barely talked about right. The book, and that's my fault. I've teed off on a lot of politics. But we go into great detail on the role of media, journalism, political advertising, long chapters on that. And the penultimate chapter is on how the Internet's being brought into the system. And it's the chapter that John and I are proudest of in the book. It basically talks about all the stuff that came out in the NSA scandal. The Obama administration elevated surveillance to an all-time new height in the last campaign. They've made surveillance of voters a key part of the election, and everyone's going to be doing it from now on. And instead of liberating us, everything about the Internet right now suggests it's going to be incorporated into the system and be a source of a very negative force in our electoral politics.
Of course, the analysis that you did already years ago on the Internet has been borne out.
Well, I let others say that without tooting my own horn.
Yeah, no, I'll toot it for you.
Thank you.
Bob McChesney, I want to thank you for coming in again on this holiday. I want to thank Steve Mikesell. I want to thank Kelsey and Carol out on the phones today. And as always, I want to thank you, our listeners, our callers. I've been your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. Hopefully next week I'll have someone on to talk about Egypt, trying to tack tack someone down here.